Okay, so welcome to the call. Welcome to my reading room. Actually, a reading room is a pretty new idea to me. I know people do it over here in the States, but I think it's a great idea. I just never thought of it before, and I decided it was time I made a start. And the idea is really just to share some work with you, and we'll discuss it. You can have your own input, in fact, towards the end of the call. But I'm not going to confine myself to just reading things. I think that would get very boring. We'll do some reading, otherwise it doesn't justify the name. but there's more to it than that, as you'll see. Now, I'm pretty sure that everybody on the call knows who I am. I've only ever circulated it to my list. So if you happen to be a guest or you're here as a suggestion of a friend, I apologize for sidestepping that part and just get to the point, which is to talk about my book, Diet Wise. And Diet Wise is really the summation of about 35 years of knowledge and experience in the field of dealing with the way various ways that foods can make you sick. We used to just call it food allergy, but we realize it's a much bigger issue than that now. And I'll explain some more of that during the series of these reading room sessions as we go on. But in that time, anyway, that was the simple working phrase. We called it food allergy. I had a very crude and very simple definition of a food allergy. That is, it was something that you ate, made you sick. You shouldn't eat it. So that's what we called it. And there was huge amounts of controversy, because one of the most outstanding things about that was that you couldn't really show any immunological mechanism. Now, in formal medicine of the time, anything that was an allergy had to have an antigen-antibody response, and you had to be able to measure the antibodies. Otherwise, it wasn't a real allergy. And, you know, it kind of spilled over from that into saying, therefore, the patient wasn't really ill. They were kind of faking it. You know, they didn't show an antigen-antibody reaction. So their patient was probably imagining it, and they got sent to see psychiatrists for help. And the book that got me started, it was published in 1976, was by a psychiatrist at a hospital in Great Britain, Basingstoke, in fact, not so far from London, and his name was Richard Mackinnis. And he wrote a book called Not All in the Mind, because that was the theme, that people were being told they were crazy, they were had psychiatric problems, and it was really what was wrong with them. And, you know, it simply wasn't. It wasn't all in the person's mind at all. And very often food was capable of provoking quite significant responses, both physical and mental illness. Hence the title of his book. Anyway, I read this book in the mid to late 70s, and I realized that it was either complete baloney or it was a big medical breakthrough. And instead of shrugging my shoulders and saying, well, it's probably baloney, like most doctors did, I decided to find out. So what I actually did was start putting people on suggested exclusion diets. And I was absolutely amazed at the recoveries that I saw. I mean, some of the transformations were almost miraculous. They took place in days. And a person was often free of a lifelong affliction. You know, somebody with asthma could hardly breathe. Suddenly threw away all the medications. They went, you know, a big gulp of good air and, you know, took up some outdoor sport. They weren't restricted at all because they could breathe easily and, you know, it was great. And all kinds of medical conditions. So I became totally committed at that point, and really that set the sail for the rest of my life. I started working with a phenomenon and I very quickly became experienced. I saw a lot of people. And by the early 80s, we were starting to make media headway. I was just saying to Bart, we were chatting before I started the call, that in those days, I didn't really fancy the idea of trying to change medical opinion. I mean, you could get very weary and die young trying to change the prejudices of the medical profession. So I actually reached out to the public. It was a conscious decision I made. I thought, well, if I changed public perception of this phenomenon, they know that it could be true, then hopefully they'll go along to their doctor and thump the table and say, could this be a food allergy? Well, for years and years and years, patients were doing that, and they were still being told, no, no such thing, it's crazy, never heard of such a thing. In my own city, food allergy was called mumby jumbo. You know, I was called a quack in the local town. And that's pretty well how primitive it was. Now, I have to tell you, there's no point in hiding the truth, but go back 10 years or so before that, when a newly qualified medical graduate, I remember myself saying the same thing. You know, you can't be allergic to food. Well, you know, just shellfish and nuts and stuff like that. But the idea of being generally allergic to food was crazy. And to my shame, I said that to a lot of patients. But I must tell you that I changed very quickly when I decided to look and actually pay attention to what patients are telling me. I have to honor my patients and say almost everything I learned from my patients. There were no textbooks. I learned it in conversation with tens of thousands of people, and they taught me all kinds of strange and wonderful manifestations that you would never expect to find in a textbook. But, you know, when you checked it out time after time after time, and it just came true so often, then you began to realize there was a phenomenon there. And that's how really scientific discoveries are really made. Enough people observe that something happens. And, you know, later on, somebody can go and check all that out with a scientific trial. But it always starts with somebody seeing that a certain thing is happening. For example, the discovery of vitamin C was based on the observation that people who ate fresh fruit and greens and vegetables didn't seem to get scurvy. We didn't discover till the 20th century what vitamin C was. But James Lind realized that citrus fruit was a nice rich source and suggested to the British Admiralty that they start feeding fresh lemon juice and lime juice to the sailors. And that means they didn't get scurvy. And there's still no scientific understanding of why, but they knew it was true that sailors fed lime juice stayed fit and well, and their counterparts in the French Navy or the Spanish Navy were racked with scurvy and the soldiers could hardly stand up, never mind fight. So that's one of the reasons why Britain came to sweep the world, and a tiny little island owned nearly two-fifths of the globe at one point. Largely due to the lime, and you've probably heard the expression they have for British people, especially British sailors. They're called limeys, and it goes back to this time. Still no science. I mean, for 200 years, it kept Britain ahead of the pack. It kept her queen of the waves, you know, rule Britannia, but no what doctors would call science. Does it matter? Well, of course, to me, it didn't matter at all. If you can show something is happening and benefit somebody, even if you don't understand why, then it's still a pretty valid phenomenon. And that's where we were in the late 70s, early 80s. You know, I saw it enough times on enough people. I had no hesitation about the fact that it was a real phenomenon, even if doctors were digging in and saying, where's the proof? You know, that was one of their first stories. Well, there's no scientific proof. Well, of course there wasn't, because nobody was investigating it. And the pompous asses were all saying there's no such thing. So, of course, they weren't going to investigate it. And then because they didn't investigate it, they can say, oh, well, there's no science, so it's definitely rubbish. You know, it was a kind of catch-22. Anyway, as I said, my decision was to ignore the medical profession and not try and change that. Just go out to the public with all these wonderful stories of amazing recoveries, and the media picked up on them over and over. And by the early 80s, things were going great. And I decided that at that time, it was time I wrote a book. There were one or two books in the arena, but they were old sort of classic hardbound textbooks. I mean, there was a book called Food Allergy, written, I think, in the 40s or late 30s, maybe. Randolph, Wrinkle and Zeller were the three authors. They wrote a wonderful book. They were pioneers to whom I take off my hat. But their book wasn't very readable. So I thought, well, you know, maybe I should contribute a book. And I set off to write myself a book in the early 80s. Well, about 83, 84, I started writing this. And I decided I would call it The Miracle Eating Plan, or The Miracle Diet. Well, I have to tell you, in the end, I changed to a different title, and it cost me millions of dollars. Robert Atkins came out at about the same time with his diet. He did really well. But the problem with calling it, I made the mistake of switching it to the title to call it The Food Allergy Plan, because that seemed to me to encapsulate what it was all about. But the trouble was, I didn't get the sales because nobody thought that applied to them. You know, somebody had arthritis and they'd say, well, I've got arthritis, I don't have food allergies. Or migraine, they'd say, I've got migraines, I don't have food allergies. So nobody would pick up the book. If they did, they'd realize it was the key to almost everything. Arthritis, colitis, asthma, eczema, migraines, even, you know, depression, all kinds of conditions in almost every organ that you can name, you know, rhinitis, chronic intermittent rhinitis, other respiratory troubles, all kinds of bowel problems. They would just resolve with this. So I thought it was a smart choice of title. But as I said, unfortunately, it didn't sell enough because people weren't aware that they needed it. I mean, gradually, you know, the sales picked up. It gathered momentum. But unfortunately, I wished I had called it the Miracle Eating Plan. It probably made me millions of dollars by the end of the 1980s. Anyway, I thought, since that's the origin of the story, I'd start with a little reading of the Food Allergy Plan. I'm only going to read a few paragraphs. I mean, that's the old story now. But let me just read you some stuff. I mean, paragraph one, for example, the introduction here is called The Miracle Eating Plan, and this was in keeping with the title of the book. If a diet had been discovered which cured a number of serious illnesses, including eczema, dermatitis, migraine, colitis, asthma, high blood pressure, obesity, depression, schizophrenia, alcoholism, peptic ulcer, and routinely alleviated a whole host of minor complaints such as abdominal bloating, mouth ulcers, itchy eyes, difficulty waking in the morning, overweight, palpitations, a flu-like state, but definitely not flu, panic attacks and foggy brain syndrome, catarrh, then you'd rightly call it a miracle diet, wouldn't you? Perhaps you're wondering if such a diet's even possible. Well, it is, and it does exist. It's been known to a small group of skilled doctors who call themselves clinical ecologists for a number of years now. It's the subject of this book. I use it regularly in my clinic, and it really can do all that's claimed above. Its concern is with food allergies, and it will uncover those items in your diet which may be resulting in non-optimum health. Okay, well, I thought that was a very gripping start, and as I said, if I'd kept the title consistent with that, it would have been good. That term clinical ecologist, we had a clinical ecology society that you had to be a doctor or a graduate to be a member. But gradually, so many people on the outside who knew nothing. I mean, I knew a taxi driver that set himself up a clinic or an office, as you call it here, and started doing all kinds of alternative treatments and nutrition and diets, and he got hold of my story about food allergies. And he started calling himself a clinical ecologist. Dang, he didn't even have a first aid certificate, never mind a medical degree. And there was lots of that. You know, somebody had got a PhD in radio electronics or something. You know, if you have a PhD, you can call yourself a doctor. Well, they did. And the next thing is they were professing being experts on this subject. So it was all rather bizarre. And eventually we changed our name from that. But clinical ecology, I think, was a great term. Remember, this was in the 80s, 70s and 80s. We were newly aware of all these environmental and ecology issues. And I thought it was important. Anyway, let me skip a few paragraphs. I'll just read you a couple of bits more and then we'll get on to diet-wise. This is all 20-some years ago, remember, 25 years ago. The food allergy plan... Oh, it's more than that. It's 30 years ago, isn't it? Where are we? No, 20-odd years ago, that's right. The food allergy plan's more than just a diet. It takes you step by step through the unmasking of hidden allergies, which may be spoiling your life. What's revolutionary about this plan is that it's not a fixed diet. We have meat-free and fruit-free, arthritis, slimming and beauty diets galore. And, you know, that's still true 20 years later. There's still hundreds of diets. But they all share one fundamental flaw. No one diet can possibly suit every case. An incorrect diet may make things worse. Of course, you never get to hear of that. You know, the Perricone diet and the Atkins and so on definitely makes some people worse, but nobody ever broadcasts that. The patients believe it's them that's at fault, and the authors never want to hear, of course, and nobody thinks of ringing up Perricone and saying, hey, do you realize I feel absolutely lousy on your diet? That wonderful food that you recommended gives me diarrhea or something like that. So at that time, there was a very fashionable diet called the Fiber Plan, or the F Plan Diet. That's, I think, what gave me the title. It was a book by Audrey Eiton. It was called the F Plan, and it was about eating fiber and eating lots of beans. And somebody joked, no wonder it's called the F Plan Diet, meaning the word fart, of course, which is the English for blowing off. So the F Plan Diet is quite amusing. But let me just read one or two other sentences I said there, because I believe it's as true today as it was then. The tracking down and uncovering of the hidden allergy effect, and I'm emphasizing here the hidden allergy effect. 99.9% of people who came to see me never knew that they were being made sick by food and other triggers in their environment. I mean, heck, if they were bad with dogs and it made them sneeze, they'd go and see the allergist and get shots. They'd never think of coming to a facility like mine. So I got people who didn't know what was wrong, and they were absolutely amazed most times to discover it was not only a food, but it was an everyday food. Anyway, coming back to the point, the uncovering of the hidden allergy effect has probably been the single most important medical discovery this century, i.e. 20th century, measured simply in terms of the amount of human suffering now to be alleviated. I avoided the word, the severity of suffering, although I've seen extremely severe conditions. But just the wide number of people, I mean, I reckon between 60 and 80% of the population suffer daily from this phenomenon without realizing it. And it was obviously a very safe approach to healing. So there was a need for it, a demand. Let me go on read a paragraph here about the medical profession, because we know that as a whole it was entrenched in the belief that diets aren't important, despite the fact that Hippocrates over 2,000 years ago stated that no healing could be truly successful without attention being paid to what the patient was eating. Instead, the conventional doctor blunders on with newer and more dangerous drugs, always ready with the knife, spurred on by more and more obscure laboratory investigations until the patient is lost in a welter of science. One wonders where it will all end, for whereas in any other profession a narrowness of view is nothing more than an infantile and unbecoming failure, in medicine it's dangerous, almost clinical, a neglect of duty which only the patient suffers. And that was the point there. Now, it formulated after I wrote that book, but it didn't take me long to formulate a whole new principle of nutrition. And the idea was that during those years, I learned that what you are eating that you shouldn't be eating was far more damaging than not eating the things that you should. You know, the traditional view of nutrition is, what do you lack? Well, you know, eat some of that. You need these vitamins, eat them. Or you need more greens and you need more of this and you eat that. It's the adding things was the view as to what nutrition was about. And if you added the right things, the person got better. Excuse me one moment. And what I'd come to realize, it's things that you shouldn't, things you didn't ought to. And that's where we made these amazing breakthroughs. Anyway, from my bios and various publications that we were very active in the media at that time, radio broadcasts all over the world, and then eventually television got interested. And they used to come on down to my office and film all kinds of interesting goings on. And it was very media newsworthy, no question. You know, people whose lives had been made miserable and atrocious suddenly get well, and it was just eating bananas that did it. That's not from a true case, but you know what I mean? I mean, the media love it. You know, they're very shallow, and they like sensational ideas. So when they hear that one simple food can make a person, they're like the boy that was made murderously violent eating potato. And it was only potato and a couple of other foods. The media loved that kind of thing. So it went on for years and years and years. It made my reputation internationally. I had some great fun. And I believe I changed the face of medicine in the UK. The old diehards are still there. But, you know, the people that, most of them have retired, thankfully, but the people that attacked me, eventually they came around to the story. And, you know, one of the big shots in one of the London hospitals that said this food allergy thing was all crap, it was a hoax. Damn me, you know, in the mid to late 70s, I saw him on television talking about food allergy. And I felt, you know, jumping into the TV set and wringing his neck saying, you faker, you told the public at large for years this wasn't true. Now you're claiming expertise in this area. Well, it's a good job he was in a remote studio, I suppose. Anyway, the times went on, things changed, we had some great fun, And eventually, with reasons I'm not going to go into, we ended up here in the US. And I want to do the same here. I have to make my mark here yet. And it will take some years. Of course it will. I got my green card finally, but I wasn't allowed to do anything until I got my green card. So that handicapped me pretty severely. But all clear now. We got the green light. And so watch out. The first project I wanted to release to the public was this book, Diet Wise. Now, there was some difficulty. There wasn't any difficulty writing this book, okay? I'm a prolific writer. I can write several thousand words a day. My brain is full of stuff. So that wasn't the issue. The issue was really, how am I going to present that? Because obviously I'm not going to write another, you know, a second edition of the Food Allergy Plan. That would have the same problem as the first one. And I chose diet-wise. Food allergy is only part of the story now. We realize in the intervening years that there are many phenomena that affect this situation and the fact that a person might react to a food. And one of the most outstanding is the modern appreciation of the fact that a lot of it's really due to minor genetic variations. These are called single nucleotide polymorphisms, SNPs. Or we just call them SNPs. And everybody has SNPs. That your DNA, you know, all the genes that run along your DNA, there are thousands of these. But often just tiny little fragments are a bit transposed. It's not enough to kill you or make you grow three arms instead of two. But it might be enough to make to say that you don't metabolize sulfur as well as you should, or you can't detox chemicals as well as you should. And remember, of course, food is just chemicals. And some of them really quite complex and even quite toxic chemicals. One of the sections in DietWise is explaining the possibilities. I mean, it would take a whole book to go into the poisons in food, but I just gave a list of examples of the ways in which food contains substances that are far from being biologically inert, are biologically quite toxic, even quite dangerous, in fact. So that's one of the phenomena. So you get that because of these genetic variations. We all, or most of us, can deal with tomato, but somebody who has a little SNP may not be able to handle tomato, so it becomes toxic for them. Logically, they get symptoms, and logically, if they stop eating tomato, they feel great. And you can multiply that by any number of foods. One of the things I realize is that there's nothing that is nothing is safe. No food, every food that you can name, I have had a person who's allergic to it. Even as innocent things as lettuce and radish, carrots. I had a kid in the early 80s who was allergic to the carrot family. The carrot family includes celery and parsnip and parsley, as well as carrot. He would get epilepsy if he ate anything in that family of foods. And I mean epilepsy. He was on drugs for it when he came to see me. It was him that realized the similarities. If you think of that family of foods, they all have the same fluffy green fronds on top. They vary underground, but on top they look pretty similar. And they were certainly pretty toxic for him. Now, for us, the carrot's almost the definition of a health food. You know, carrot juice or carrot as a basis for a smoothie. So nothing is safe. Once you realize this phenomenon of food allergy and genetic incompatibility kicks in, I've even had people allergic to water from different springs. And you might say, well, that's crazy. That's just water. Well, it isn't just water. In spring water, there's a vast number of deposits, organic things, molds, dead organisms, and minerals and all kinds of chemicals leached through the rocks. So, in fact, it's all quite distinct. One of my favorite waters, Badoit, great taste. It's a French water, Badoit. I love it, Badoit. But, you know, it's got so much uranium in it, it's amazing it doesn't glow in the dark. So I had to give up drinking it. Not good for me. But I'm just illustrating the point that waters are very variable. And today, most spring waters anyway come in plastic bottles. So a really sensitive person's on a hiding to nothing, because even if the water was great, by the time it's sat for 3 weeks in a plastic bottle, it's practically a solution of plastic rather than water, and the person reacts. So no wonders, no surprises there. So as I said, the idea here was how to present the book. So I chose Diet Wise, and I I lingered some while over this secondary title, Let Your Body Choose the Food That's Right for You, in the hope that most smart readers or bookshop browsers would get the message in just a few words, that everyone is different and that your body is the final arbiter, as it were. If you eat the food and feel lousy, your body's telling you not to eat it. I think when the second edition comes around, I might change that to surprising ways that foods can make can really hurt you. Surprising ways that foods can really hurt you. Because I think people have not understood this, that it can be very severe indeed, that people, you know, are on stretchers, can't walk, wheelchairs, motor neuron degenerative disease, and all kinds of really dramatic, even potentially fatal illnesses. And the person gets well. You know, you put them on the right diet and they get well. It looks like a miracle. But the mechanism isn't really miraculous. The mechanism has to do with what we call body load. The body's overloaded. Something's going to break down. And the symptom really relates to whatever breaks down first. If the skin gets the attack, you get rashes. If the lungs gets attacked, you get asthma or wheezing or something similar to that. So the symptoms aren't really very important. It's the mechanism by which it happens, the overload mechanism, which is the important thing. So somebody who's got a genetic disease and then they also overload with foods will have it worse. They will have it sooner. And I even saw definitely genetic diseases. I mean, like muscular dystrophy, for example. No question. It's inherited. It's in the genes. But you put the person on the diet and they recovered. Like a child who was facing paralysis because of muscular dystrophy, that's a progressive weakness until they die around 10 or 11, 12 years old, suddenly stops. The progress doesn't only stop, but the disease goes into reverse. The child recovers all the muscular function. And you'd have to say, huh? How could that? Even me, you know, I was humble enough, well, arrogant enough, I suppose, but humble enough to realize that we didn't know nothing. We didn't understand this at all. But it was certainly connected with the phenomenon of load. Nowadays, we've got a clearer view of it. This whole science we call nutrigenomics, meaning nutrition and genes. And it's very clear that you can switch a gene off by changing your diet, by eating good, friendly, gene-friendly, low-overload foods. You can actually turn off a bad gene. And by the same token, if you eat badly and you overload on junk food and manufactured crap, you're going to turn on some bad genes and you're going to die young. So it's very important. And this subject of nutrigenomics is something for the future that you're going to hear more and more and more about. Because it's not just food, it affects things like our processing of chemicals, it affects the way we respond to drugs. You know, the FDA, bless them, nobody likes the FDA, I don't think, at least I've yet to meet somebody that does, or certainly nobody trusts them. But, you know, they're on the case. They did bring out a position paper about 2 years ago, it was in March, so it was 2 years ago, yeah, where they recognize this phenomenon, this term has been invented, personalized medicine. And they're saying if you give somebody a drug that they don't tolerate because you didn't bother to test them for SNPs and see if they were metabolically compatible with this, then you could be on a charge of negligence and malpractice. So even the FDA recognizes it. Times are changing. It's mostly to do with preventing drug deaths and preventing lawsuits, I'm sure. But the same principle applies to food and diet. Okay, so talked a lot about the origin of the book. It's a self-help book. It was intended to be a self-help book and has remained so. Obviously, a physician working in an office, I could do things that the man on the street couldn't do. Not the least of which, for example, was give inoculations of allergens. Now, let me tell you, I've never used scratch and prick tests. I'm sure you've all heard of those. You scratch the skin, you drop some rabbit fur on it or some cat fur and see what happens. Well, all you can say really is if something happens, it probably means something. But if it doesn't happen, it doesn't mean anything. The person could be violently allergic to it, and yet you not get a significant allergic reaction when you test in that way. It's a very clumsy way. And in fact, let me digress for a moment. Listen, I will get to reading eventually. But let me digress for a moment to talk about the work of hypnotist Stephen Black. He was a British MD and a brilliant hypnotist, and he worked in the 40s and 50s. And he did some awesome experiments hypnotizing people and telling them they were allergic to things and they reacted violently. And then he'd hypnotize them again and tell them they weren't allergic, and they were fine. They could eat lashings of it or breathe tons of cat fur or whatever it was. No problem. He actually got very sophisticated and was able to hypnotize a person and say, in your left arm, you will have an allergic reaction when you're tested, and in your right arm, nothing will happen. And under the power of hypnotism, that's exactly what happened. The person got a shot in the right side, nothing, no sign of the allergy. A shot in the left side and a huge, big, fiery wheel that said the person is definitely allergic to cat fur or dog dander, whatever it was. So do you see what I'm saying? With the power of the mind in the equation like that, who on earth is to know? The person may be allergic, but just wouldn't necessarily show up. So that kind of testing has never enjoyed a very good reputation. You can say, in the most hesitant terms, if you see a reaction, it might mean something, but if you see no reaction, forget it. We used to use a different system where we'd actually take a syringe loaded with a substance and actually inject it, split the layers of the skin and actually inject the inoculum and make a wheal deliberately. You know, a wheal, the little sort of swollen, pale patch. We could measure that, and then we could re-measure it again, say 10 minutes later, and measure a significant increase. Even if it was small, it was accurate. You could measure it. But what was amazing with that method was that we often got the symptom. It was called provocation testing. You know, you'd give a person a shot of, say, corn, and they'd go into their asthma attack. So that corn was one of the triggers. We then gave weaker and weaker dilutions of the same extract until we came to a sort of switch-off effect. And we call this the neutralizing dose. We could use that as treatment, as therapy. The person was administered those as sublingual drops. In some centers, they used to get the patient to give themselves shots. But I think that was pretty barbaric for kids. I used to like sublingual drops. We did that for 20 years more. And doctors scoffed, of course. They said it was all voodoo and, again, mumby-jumbo. I can't tell you now how many papers, scientific papers, published in top reputable journals have come out. There's one only about 2 weeks ago came out talking about sublingual therapy for allergies, how effective it is, how simple, easy, economical it is. It makes you sick because we can't turn back the clock and get apologies from all these idiots that were so rude. And I mean, rude on a big scale, you know. I've been blagged on television and on radio. Mostly I was there to defend myself, but, you know, sometimes not. So we were able to see things that really nobody else could see. And this was how I was able to make some quite startling discoveries, like people, for example, a person, a young girl who had epilepsy due to house gas, you know, the gas you use to cook on the stove, the same stuff that's supplied at school to the laboratory and Bunsen burners. So you can imagine the difficulty this lass had. She'd been to the Great Ormond Street Hospital in London, and they didn't know what to do with her. They just gave her drugs. And they actually got quite interested. I must say, one of the paediatricians, to be fair, this was back in the 80s and nothing short of amazing, started writing to me about what I discovered and how I discovered it. But he never took it further. It's just too big a paradigm shift for most of them. Anyway, what I'm saying is that this is a self-help book. I have not dwelt on that kind of scientific detailed investigation because it's beyond the reach of the ordinary person. And, I'm not sure it's appropriate, really. So it's a diet-wise for the layman. And it's written in layman's language. Let's take a look. The introduction, I just talked about the original detox diet. The diet on which this is based was the very first of these diets where you give up things and you feel great. There's more to it than just, you know, cabbage water and things like that, which are some of the extreme diets today. But a lot of people now use this term without ever understanding the origin of detox. What the original story was. But the story was that people who are allergic to foods and other substances that they eat and are not tolerant of them are very often addicted, really addicted. And I mean, they get severe withdrawal symptoms when you avoid the food. If any of you, for example, given up smoking, you know that it feels pretty rough for a few days. You know for sure the one thing that would relieve it is another cigarette. If you've been bad with coffee and headaches and so on, if you give up coffee, If you've not done it, you may have seen somebody do it. The person's practically a basket case. For days, they get severe reactions because they're not able to dose or fix themselves. You know the way a heroin addict, say, takes a fix. It makes them feel better, but only because the heroin's making them feel lousy in the first place. Okay, so the original detox diet. It's only a short section. Let me just read that for you. 30 years ago, a handful of doctors, myself among them, began working with what today is called a detox diet. Imagine an eating plan which could cure a number of serious illnesses, including but not limited to eczema, dermatitis, migraine, colitis, high blood pressure, obesity, anorexia, depression and alcoholism, as well as a whole host of minor complaints such as headaches, belly aches, joint pains, low moods, abdominal bloating, catarrh, difficulty waking in the morning, overweight, palpitations, panic attacks, inability to concentrate, that's woolly brain, loss of libido and general fatigue. I expect you would consider it a very remarkable diet. We did. If it also enabled you to look good, feel good, lose lots of weight without needing to feel hungry, give you boundless, zestful energy, got rid of age spots and wrinkles, made you look a dozen years younger, and yet was relatively easy to do, you could hold to it for life, although you're allowed to break it in its demands once in a while, then you'd probably regard that as a miracle, right? Well, it's not really a miracle, it's just advanced science. I've used my own version of this plan in my office for over a quarter of a century. I'm going to teach you everything you need to know right here in these pages to do it for yourself, without medical help, without specialist knowledge. This may be the only diet book that you'll ever need. Sound unbelievable? Well, just keep reading. It's all here, but don't skip. This book is totally different from anything that you've read before. There's a very special reason why I called it Diet Wise, which will become clear as we go along. You need to understand how the plan works and why. The early chapters lay down important groundwork for success, and you'll learn things your doctor probably doesn't even know about, much less discuss with you. Later, we get to know how to carry out the actual steps. Be patient. This is a whole revolution we're talking about here. It's a lot to absorb. I was taught these little-known secrets by early pioneers and got miraculous results which catapulted me into media fame around the world. For the first time in my career as a physician, I began to see real recoveries, real cures. I saw fewer patients because it takes longer using this route, as you would say. But I made more sincere and lasting friends among my patients than I ever did in the bad old days of pill pushing. In fact, for 30 years, I've hardly prescribed a pharmaceutical drug. Those who need them can always get them from eager doctors whose approach to disease is dictated by the pseudoscience of Big Pharma. I have become a teacher in turn and realized that what I've learned over the decades is a considerable body of diet wisdom that's vital for everyone. This book summarizes most of what I know and is intended for those who want to take control of their own health and learn the whys and wherefores of body function and nutritional science. And in there, I'll finish reading for the moment, that's the core of really where we're going with this, that the person has to be able to manage their own diet and their own lifestyle. And the only way you're going to be able to do that is to understand what's happening. You may have recognized a couple of paragraphs I pinched from the other book. Well, why not? That was the original incarnation of this book, but of course the modern one has got much wider application. It's sad to report that even after all those years, doctors were still pretty ignorant. Okay, let's go on and maybe we'll do section one. I'm going to miss some bits out, I think, especially where it relates to what we've already talked about in diet-wise, in the food allergy plan. And then we'll open up for questions and discussion. I don't know if Kay's Connecticut's here tonight. I hope she is. She shot me an email last night. She's lost over 50 pounds so far using this program. It's not just a weight loss program, but that's one of the nice side effects. You can eat humongous amounts of food and still lose weight, because it's what you eat that I found is important, not how much you eat, but what you eat. I've seen people eat more food and lose weight because they switched from bad foods that were hurting their metabolism to good foods that their bodies liked very much and said, yum yum, give me more. Alright, chapter 1, pills for everything. Chronic pill popping is one of the hallmarks of our age. Conventional medicine has sold us on the idea that there's a chemical for everything, from bereavement to schizophrenia, panic attacks to asthma, heartburn to malignant tumours. This is the mentality which insists that depression is just a Prozac deficiency. This is the floundering science that says the answer to side effects from drugs is more drugs. But my standpoint is that any chronic medication is by definition a failure. It doesn't cure. If it did, there'd be no need to continue taking it. The best that this kind of therapy can do is to treat symptoms. But even then, it only masks them, because it's not based on solving the cause of the problem, but on suppressing the results. This has been likened to covering up the oil warning light on your automobile. The symptom, that's the red light, goes away, but the oil pressure still remains too low, and your automobile will die young. If only my colleagues understood this in full. I'd like to offer you my own unique definition of a successful cure, which is brutal and short. No symptoms, no treatment. If the condition needs repeated treatment, even holistic remedies to keep symptoms at bay, it's not a cure. No disease, no treatment, no requirement for treatment, that's a cure. And the only way you're going to get this happy result is to call up Mother Nature. Without her, you'll cure nothing, heal nothing, and solve nothing. So let me just break for a moment to make that point about holistic and alternative remedies. Most of those suffer from the same fatal flaw. You need to go on taking them. This is great for the commercial empire of herbalism and homeopathy and all these things. But, you know, if what I said is true, if the person was really healthy and well, they wouldn't need anything. They wouldn't even need holistic remedies. They wouldn't need acupuncture. They wouldn't need to go and have a massage. They wouldn't need to sit down with a therapist every week. They'd be cured. They'd be well. So that's really the definition of a cure. And I'm happy to say I hit on a cure lots of times. I used to do my stats regularly for about 15 years. Then I gave up. They were boringly predictable. We used to get 60% of people totally well. They gave up all their medications. All their symptoms went away, provided they stuck with the advice. And this is that itself, by the way, is pretty dramatic, because we got mostly the failures. We got people that nobody else could help, the medical profession had failed on. They were often loaded with drugs, they were often very sick, they were desperate, and they came to me, and yet they got well. So what's that telling you? I mean, we're talking about real causes, or close to real causes. If it's not the actual the cause, it's pretty close on it, isn't it? If by just changing your diet and avoiding certain foods, all of the disease goes away, that's worthwhile. So 60%. Another 25%, we used to get dramatically better. Their symptoms went away or were very much better. They were able to give up or very significantly reduce their medication. But, you know, it wouldn't quite qualify as a cure by the definition I just gave. That leaves 15% or so, which splits about half. So about 7%. I couldn't help. I had no idea what was wrong with them, and I failed to solve it one way or the other, even using other aspects of nutrition, other kinds of treatment, using chemical allergy approach, environmental allergies. I got flummoxed. That's a pretty good score, though, 7%, bearing in mind the medical profession, its failure rate's way in the 90%, way into the 90s. And the other 7% just simply didn't do it. I'm not counting those as failures. You know, if somebody has been told if they don't eat wheat, they'll be cured, and they insist on eating wheat, what can I do? So that's I don't rate that as a failure. So 7% dropped out or wouldn't comply, 7% couldn't be helped. The rest were great. Okay, next little section is called Stay Well and Live Long, because that's another important part of this message. This was really the beginning of my anti-aging education, because I heard this story so many hundreds, thousands of times. People would go on this plan, and their friends would say, hey, you look great, you look 10 years younger, what are you doing, what's the secret? And of course that was great, good for their ego, because, you know, most of my patients were women, always have been, and they'd feel good about that. Well, it wasn't just that they looked great, they actually did reverse aging to a degree. They were physically younger, measurably so, when you get diagnostic machines that's capable of measuring phenomena like that, what we call biological age. We saw that it was true. They really did get younger biologically speaking, not calendar-wise, of course. Right, let me continue to read for a few paragraphs. You don't need to be sick to benefit from this plan. If you consider yourself fit and well, follow these steps and stay well for the rest of your life. We now know that what you eat is a crucial and personal thing. What you eat interacts with your genes, and not every food is right for your genetic makeup. You'll probably live longer if you customize your diet and figure out which foods are best for you. That's what this book is about. It's the crucial aspect of this book. But the truth is that most of us are not really as healthy as we should be. Maybe you don't admit to serious symptoms, but are you bounding with abundant energy, radiantly happy and fulfilled in all aspects of your life? If not, then you're not in a true state of wellness. That's something else that my conventional colleagues have sold to everybody, that health is merely the absence of disease. I should have said absence of diagnosable disease. Well, this is not good enough. A positive sense of well-being and plenty of energy available whenever needed is what should be regarded as optimal health. That's real vitality. Maybe you had it as a child and have lost it. Maybe you never felt that good. In which case, you've something delightful to discover about healthy living. It feels great, like being in love, getting a big raise or promotion, publishing your first novel and winning the state lottery, all rolled into one. When would be a good time to rediscover the best feelings of your life, to regain lost youth and beat off those annoying little signals of less than perfect health? And if not now, when? I'll just read one more section and we'll discuss a bit more. The title for this section is called Eating Dangerously, comes from a book published in 1976 by a UK physician named Richard Mackinnis. It was published in Britain as Not All in the Mind. Remember, I've already referred to that. It became something of a classic, and many years later I was asked to write a foreword by the publishers Thorsons, now an imprint of HarperCollins. And I compared it to other radical and seminal alternative books, such as Silent Spring by Rachel Carson and Small is Beautiful by Ernest Schumacher. This is not mentioned in the book, I'm taking a few seconds out. Diet for a Small Planet by Francis Moore-Lappe. Do you remember that book? It's a gorgeous book. These are very significant books in the march of human evolution. Mackinnis's message was that food can make you ill, sometimes very ill. I read Eating Dangerously a few years after it was published, and it changed my career. Oh, I've said that. Let me skip forward a bit. Make no mistake, food can hurt you. In fact, it can make your life hell. And I'm not talking just about junk food, a common misconception, but about good whole food, milk, eggs, whole grain wheat, fruit, and so on. You've been told these foods are healthy and no doubt good for you. But I've a different message for you. Supposedly healthy natural foods can make some individuals very ill. I've had thousands of patients whose lives are being ruined by eating wholesome foods that they personally did not tolerate, but were unaware where the trouble was coming from. This goes beyond mere food allergy. You might think that allergy to food is rare and has nothing to do with you, and you'd be mistaken. But it's emerged recently at the cutting edge of science that our genes, which dictate so much of our health, also control our food tolerances. A food which is right for one person may be disastrous in the metabolic pathways of another. A modern genetic version of Lucretius's old saw, one man's meat is another man's poison. The important point for the moment is not why it happens. The critical element is that it can happen with any food, any individual. Avoiding these foods is the key to a long and healthy life. The trouble is that you may not be aware that foods are affecting you in this way. We talk of a hidden allergy or a masked intolerance to food. This mechanism will be explained in due course, but as the name suggests, it may not be obvious at all where the problem is coming from. Hidden allergies or genetic intolerance can occur to foods eaten frequently, even daily, and yet remain undetected. Curiously, a person may even become addicted to his or her incompatible foods. He or she likes the very thing that's causing the problem. Okay, I've stopped reading again, but this is time to repeat that very important point, that favourite foods and people getting hooked on foods is one of the biggest signs. One of my questionnaires that I used to have a set questionnaire, because it's a very quick way of filtering people to see could I help or couldn't I help. And various of the questions were to do with food addictions, and like what happens if you go many hours without food. And people who say, you know, they get a headache or they go into a crash or they start shaking, you know for sure that that's food withdrawal symptoms. So it's really quite a giveaway. Again, remember, I'm not reading. Another great sign is first thing in the morning when a person wakes up. You know that feeling, we joke about it, and it's feeling like death warmed up. You know that saying? People might be crabby, tired, irritable when they first wake up. It takes a lot to get them started. That's a great sign of food addiction and therefore food allergy. Why is that? Well, a person, by the time you wake up, you've been off food maybe 12 to 14 hours. And that's often sufficient to enable the food withdrawal mechanisms to set up. By the time you come around to breakfast, you've been off food, say, 12 or 14 hours, and you need a fix. So the person has a typical breakfast, which would contain wheat and dairy and sugar and caffeine, some corn perhaps, depends what the addiction is. That solves the problem. It relieves the withdrawal symptoms. Within an hour, the person feels better, and they go through the day. If it's coffee, for example, I mean, a classic place to see food allergies is in the queue at Starbucks. And you often see people already beginning to twitch, and they're very irritable and grumpy because they're waiting for their fix. Once they get their first coffee with their cream and latte, whatever it is, then they feel better, and they talk to the same person 2 hours later. They're like a different human being. But they have to keep dosing on that food all day. That's why you see people walking around with 32-ounce tubs of coffee. I mean, the sight is appalling, but volume speaks eloquently to someone with my knowledge and experience that the person is hooked on the stuff. And while I'm at it, I make the point that very often the reason a person is hooked on drinks like that is not the caffeine. Could be, but very often it's the dairy. The person is hooked on milk, so they want the cream, they want the latte, they want the cappuccino. And if you just gave them black coffee, it wouldn't do them any good. It wouldn't resolve, it wouldn't relieve the symptoms, the withdrawal symptoms that they're suffering from. So a good tip for you there, if you think you might be addicted, try drinking tea or coffee without any milk and see what happens. And if you still get the same feeling, then you know it's withdrawals. It's the same with hunger. Hunger is a withdrawal symptom, okay? It sounds crazy. You think, well, obviously. No, but I mean, a withdrawal symptom. If you go on a fast and after a week you haven't eaten, you don't feel hungry. You're past the withdrawal symptoms at that point. I mean, the only reason people can go 10, 20, 30 days on a fast is that they don't feel hungry. They don't suffer. Various things happen physiologically. They may even hallucinate. But they don't suffer hunger. They don't get the cravings. Those disappear after 3 or 4 days. And that's a sign of addiction to the food. So hunger, when you see, if somebody's hungry and we say, well, here you are, drink this carrot juice and eat this stick of celery, the person says, I don't want that garbage, I want a burger or something. Then you know that really what they're looking for is the wheat, the wheat in the bun, and that's probably the addiction. And if you, without the bun, they're not happy. They don't feel they've eaten properly, or they say, I'm still hungry. And they mean, I still have my withdrawal symptoms. They haven't been relieved. So listen, folks, if any of these clues apply to you, then know that the story applies to you and you need some help. You need to work through this. If you've read the book, I know a lot of you listening have got the book and you want some inspiration and ideas. Maybe you found it a little tough. Well, start it in stages. At the very least, look at the things. Then the suspect foods. I always used to do this with foods. The number one thing I did with a person, the number one input information is, what are you eating? And it contained almost all the clues I needed to know. And I'd start by making a list of foods that the person eats every day. And I mean every day, not often, not most days, every day. So that's things like coffee, but not just coffee. Is there sugar in the coffee? Is there milk? Is it cappuccino? Do they sprinkle it with chocolate? Okay, well, that's three foods right off that they're having every day. Three foods on a daily basis. A person might say they have salads. And I say, well, is that every day? No, most days. So we have to go through it. You know, do we eat tomato every day? Actually, most people do now, whether or not it's in a salad. Do you eat lettuce every day? Not necessarily, and so on. And what you're looking for is the frequently eaten foods, because 99% of the time, that's where the trouble lies. So you could do yourself a really quick favor by making a list of things you eat every day and then just stop them. One or two of you, I think, went into a shaking trance at the thought of that. But really, it's a very simple, fast fix of the problem. You will get withdrawal symptoms, almost for sure. If you do, hang out some flags, because you can say, hooray, we've hit it. If you give up any bunch of food, even if you give up just two foods or three foods and get a lousy withdrawal symptom, you feel ill, you get a headache, you're fatigued, you're irritable, then know for sure that one or more of those foods was doing you harm. It's a rule, an absolute rule about addictions, that if it relieves the symptoms, it's causing the symptoms in the first place. And just relate that to what you know about heroin addiction, for example, or cocaine addiction. So a quick tip for you. Okay, well, I'm not going to go any further tonight without opening things up to discussion. I'd like to know what folks here want to talk about. And I can share the discussion, in other words, and also by answering questions, of course, find out what people really want to know. So just give me a second. I'll unmute, and there we go.